남돈 토르바 데발라야 고르탕고 렉바 생화 생활라야 고르탕고.
In order to cause thoughts that are proliferating to come in and relax, then sing a song. In order to awaken your mind's clarity, sing a song. When you are sad, in order to clear away your discouragement, sing a song. When you are arrogant, in order to clear away your pride, sing a song. That's why songs are very important.
Yeah.
I still have the old melody of this in my head, so I have to ask my brother how to sing this. At the feet of Abba, the translator, I bow down. This song is on how to approach reality. Where there's nothing that's seen, this is seen by far supreme. This is the innate mind, the luminous light. Where there's nothing to search for, this the discovery supreme. This is the innate mind, the treasure trove. Where there's nothing to be eaten, O satiation supreme. The food of samadhi, the food that liberates. Where there's nothing to be drunk, O satisfaction supreme. This is the drink of bodhicitta amrita. This is original wisdom, simply aware of itself. This is the realm of the inexpressible. This is not within reach of Shravakas or naive ones, nor is it the sphere of experience of a logician. If you realize reality past all bestowing and past all receiving empowerment supreme. If you realize reality past all high and low, this is what's known as the Bhumifa supreme. If you realize reality which is unreachable by advancing along a path that's the path supreme. If you realize reality past all birth and death, this is what's known as fulfilling the highest need. If you realize reality past all perception, this is what's known as the valid cognition supreme. If you realize reality past all greater and less, this is what's known as the jnana for supreme. If you realize reality past all good and bad, this is what's known as the method for supreme. If you realize as reality, past duality. This is what's known as view by far supreme. If you realize reality free of reference point, this is what's known as meditation supreme. If you realize reality free of adopting and free of rejecting, that's conduct far supreme. If you realize reality free of all effort and strain, this is what's known as fruition far supreme. Very nice.
Very nice. Very good.
We'll turn to page 185 in the text. There are different traditions of teaching in a university setting. One is that the teacher will give a lot of general explanation first and talk about general things and then start explaining the text. And another way is just to get straight into the text itself. So I will follow the second way now. And one reason for doing it this second way is that if you just talk about all kinds of other things at the beginning, you run out of time to describe what the point is.
The
first five lines read, "The penetration of levels through application should be known to entail the following four steps. Through intense application involving informed commitment, the stage where training is done through informed commitment comprises the step of definitive verification." What we're going to have here is another presentation, the second presentation the text makes about the four paths of the Mahayana, the first one being included, the first path, the path of accumulation, being included together with the second, the path of application. So you get four explicit paths that are mentioned. And again, we start with this path of application. This is in the section on wisdom, which is the support for transformation. The first presentation was in the beginning of the explanation of the detailed explanation of pure being. And when we put these two together, then we get a clear understanding of the stages of the paths and the grounds or levels of the Mahayana. So the first part is about the path of application. So when it says the penetration of levels through application, that's just referring to all of the paths in general. Should be known to entail the following four steps. These being definitive verification, encounter, recollection, and immersion into the core. So first comes definitive verification, and it's described in these three lines. Through intense application involving informed commitment, the stage where training is done through informed commitment comprises the step of definitive verification. So what's emphasized here is informed commitment. What that means is that at this point, you don't have a direct realization of pure being yet. So what you have is a commitment to it, a belief in it. You have this conceptual certainty that you've come to through listening and reflecting, and that serves as the basis of your meditation at this stage. That's why it's called the stage of informed commitment. And again, like was explained before, you use that to definitively verify for yourself what the true nature of reality is, so that you can meditate on it. Your meditation becomes increasingly subtle until at the end of this path of application, you have only the tiniest concepts left when you're meditating.
Soso rabdu toba ye jurwe san nan tangbo de, teni rikpe ne kapso.
To connect with superior first-hand realization is the first of the levels, the stage the precise is encountered. This is then talking about the path of vision, called that because you have the vision of the true nature of reality, which you've never seen before. This is, in contrast to informed commitment, superior first-hand realization, direct realization. And this is the stage the precise is encountered. So the precise here is another synonym for the true nature of reality. Here it's called the precise nature of reality because it's precisely that. It's nothing other than that. It's precisely that and only that. Pure being, non-dual, beyond conceptual fabrication. And when one realizes this, one is on the first of the bodhisattva levels or grounds, the ground of excellent joy.
Ta gomlo yeba ne gombe rapto jurwe ne mata pa ye sa ta 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 pa sa no sombo te tene jide ne gapso.
Through intense application employing meditation, the impure levels, followed by those which are pure, are what comprise the stage of recollection. So after the bodhisattva leaves the first bodhisattva ground and moves to the second, then the bodhisattva is on this path of meditation, which is here called the stage of recollection, meditating again and again on the true nature of reality, and as that meditation becomes more and more bright, more and more lucid, and more all-encompassing of all situations, then the bodhisattva traverses the remaining nine grounds. So these remaining nine grounds are divided into six impure grounds and three pure ones. The difference between them is that on the six impure grounds, the bodhisattva still has what's called clinging to attributes. And on the three remaining grounds, the eighth, ninth, and tenth, that clinging to attributes is purified, and all that's left is called mere dualistic appearance. So clinging to attributes, if you remember, the first type of clinging that the bodhisattva eliminated on the first ground was the clinging to true existence. So from the first ground to the end of the seventh, the bodhisattva in the post-meditative stage does not cling to anything that appears to them as being truly existent, but they still fabricate attributes. characteristics. So this is like being in a dream when you know you're dreaming, but at the same time, you perceive blue, red, hot, cold, and so forth. You fabricate all of these attributes. You just don't take them to be truly existent. At the point the bodhisattva reaches the eighth bodhisattva ground, they're not doing that even anymore. They're not projecting attributes. They are just projecting mere dualistic appearance. And that is all that's left in its most subtle form when the bodhisattvas enter this vajra-like samadhi at the end of the 10th ground, and then they don't even fabricate duality in any way at all, and that's when they attain enlightenment. Through application involving final perfection, the spontaneous deeds of a Buddha continually flow. Hence, this is the stage of immersion into the core. Through application involving final perfection. Final perfection meaning that now the bodhisattva has completely cleared away all of the obscurations. And so their realization of pure being, that is non-dual original wisdom, is completely perfect. And when that happens, the spontaneous deeds of a Buddha continually flow. So at that point, the Buddha's enlightened activity being defined as activity that's for the benefit of others, is uninterrupted. Because up until this point, when the bodhisattva is resting in meditation, meditative equipoise, then that's not performing the benefit of others. Right? But in the post-meditative stage, they perform the benefit of others. But now, when they become an enlightened Buddha, then there's no difference anymore between meditation and post-meditation. So there is continuous benefit for others being performed. And why is that? We can still ask. And the reason is that it's that what is being realized is omniscient wisdom, the luminous nature of mind, which is naturally endowed from the beginning with compassion. So it's that what is being realized is not mere emptiness. If it were just emptiness, then when you realized it, what would be the benefit to others of that? But because what's being realized is the all-pervading luminosity of the true nature of mind, which is naturally endowed with wisdom and compassion, then by perfectly realizing that, the deeds of enlightenment are uninterrupted and infinite, benefiting infinite beings in an uninterrupted way. At the same time, the Buddha is totally non-conceptual when being of benefit to others. So this seems to us to be a paradox. How could it be that the Buddha performs benefit for infinite beings without ever having to contemplate doing that? That's what's meant by natural or spontaneous, is the non-conceptual aspect. So if we want to learn more about why this is not a paradox, how it actually can be like that, then we should study the chapter on enlightened activity from the text called the Gyulama, or the Treatise on the Buddha Nature. Because it uses lots of examples to address this point of how it could be that the Buddha can perform enlightened activity non-conceptually. And one of the examples is that this text mentions is the emanations of Brahma. It said that Brahma lives in this sapphire pure realm, the Hindu god Brahma, and then his reflection goes from his sapphire palace all over the world. So this is an example that nobody really has any experience with. So it's difficult as an example, because the example should be something that you have experience with to illuminate something you don't. But if you don't even have experience with the example, then it's difficult. So Rinpoche says a better example is CNN. Because CNN is seen in over 160 million homes, according to their website, in 200 countries. And it could be a billion if there were a billion television sets. There's no limit to the number of television sets on which CNN can appear. And at the same time, the person who's being broadcast on CNN doesn't have any thought of like, oh, now I have to go appear on all these different television sets. It's due to the coming together of all of the causes and conditions of the person having the fortune to be able to have a television set and to turn it on to the right channel and watch it, and then the image just appears. So that's like emanations. There doesn't have to be a concept of it. They don't have to have a concept to appear in this or that place to do things. And just like the person on CNN can say things which can be of benefit to others, so it is that the emanations of the Buddha can appear in this non-conceptual way due to the luminous nature of the mind and be of benefit to others. This melody.
The penetration of levels through application should be known to entail the following four steps. Through intense application involving informed commitment, the stage where training is done through informed commitment comprises the step of definitive verification. To connect with superior first-hand realization is the first of the levels, the stage the precise is encountered through intense application, employing meditation. The impure levels followed by those which are pure are what comprise the stage of recollection. Through application involving final perfection, the spontaneous deeds of a Buddha continually flow. Hence, this is the stage of immersion into the core.
Da nenjer jekab je yang lam yete chen do na yapare. Pekela chikja chetu pone doga.
Rala.
Teni jana nyambon do na teni sarbo chagri samayo.
Now it'd be good to recite the verses from the section on transformation that explain the four paths, and these start so that we can see the connection being between the two, and this starts on page
117. Embe doje yezebe dube jola tamje do.
The term definitive verification of this refers to the whole of the path of application, composed of appropriate mental cultivation, based on the sutra collections of Mahayana.
Rimbayanda Dandoji Tovelanje Mazomje Tordodeje Nidoji Nyazunyawa Kayimbao.
The encounter attained because of authentic view is the path of vision on which the suchness attained is in a fashion direct whatever experience.
Jesu Demba Rebene Tove Dola Gomlaji Sancho Soje Dubade Dene Tema Zereze.
Although reality has been seen by awareness, recollection, the path of meditation, composed of factors inducing enlightenment, is needed to eliminate the stains.
Yeah, London. do navadeya ne jorba jobayenu.
Hear immersion into its core complete is suchness rendered free of any stain, where all appear exclusively as suchness, and this completes the transformation as well.
Then in the cups of Tropa, you know, said the Yachi, number two said the. Then a chotema, Nanjaji Yava Chibu Caps of my subject, my don't do retention, Lola Zono, Yagona, Sixty Woman de Lelagnum. In a de Nikai, Panyam Bondona, then a Sarpochagrisabi.
If you're memorizing these verses, then in Tibetan, then the verses that come later are a little bit easier to memorize, because in the Tibetan there's this cut in the last line, and the end of the last line is attached in the commentary to the beginning of the next section. But in any event, if you bring both of these two explanations together, then your understanding of the paths will be clear.
Dor dupa, jebar sheba, ton dova, pedan jarva, penam soche de sheba, ton soche de sheba, so, sheter haja mambu irate, danda, lobdem drabo, tole labes, hile labes at the dendrabo somberendo. The Sanjit.
There are lots of different styles that the Buddha used to give explanations in the Mahayana. And these styles were also adopted in these commentaries of the classic texts. So you find concise explanation, then expanded explanation, then summary. Sometimes you find explanation of the example and the exemplified together. Then you get an extensive explanation of the example and then an extensive explanation of the meaning exemplified. And all of these ways are devices the Buddha used to make these teachings easier for us to understand. So it's just like in a textbook you study in school. First you get a synopsis at the beginning, or an abstract, and then you get the complete explanation, and then you get a summary at the end, so that it helps you to understand. That's the point of it. The author of this commentary is Ju Mipham Rinpoche, and he was a student both of Khyentse Pema Donga Lingpa, who was a great Nyingma master, and Jamgon Kontro Lodru Taye, a great Kagyu master. And so his teachings are important in both the Kagyu and the Nyingma lineages. And he lived in the latter part of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, and so his writing style is modern, and therefore it's clear and easy to understand. He lived from 1846 to 1912. Generally, great masters of all four traditions of Sakya, Geluk, Kagyu, and Nyingma composed commentaries to explain the meaning of this text, distinguishing phenomena and pure being. And that's how it is with all of the great classic texts. There are many commentaries written to explain them. From among all of these from among all of these commentaries that were composed, the one that is not too short and not too long, at the same time clear and easy to understand, so therefore the best is this one by Mipham Rinpoche. That's my opinion. The reason why there are so many commentaries written on these texts is that their meaning is so profound. So there are different ways of explaining them. And so, for example, with the Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way by Nagarjuna, even in India alone, it said there were 27 great commentaries, and then many more in Tibet. But nowadays, it's easy to do research on all of these commentaries. Like, you could have all 27 up on your computer screen, and you could look at one at a time, like that. So these computers make doing research like this simple.
This
was impossible in previous times, but now researchers and publishers of Buddhist works are using this technology to great advantage. For example, there are 4 editions of the Tenjur, which is the canon of commentaries that explain the Buddha's own words and includes teachings like this one, this text by Maitreya. There are 4 different editions of the Tenjur, and now one complete work is being published that shows exactly what the difference is in every edition for any text. One was used as the model, and then the differences of the other 3 were put in there, and all that's possible because of computer. You could do the same thing with the Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way. You could put the 27 texts that are commentaries into the computer, and you'd immediately see the differences in the style of explanation. For example, the great translator Geoffrey Hopkins studied Tsongkhapa's text called the Drange Lekshen Nyingpo, which means the essence of an excellent explanation distinguishing the provisional and the definitive meaning. And there were many commentaries written on this in the great monasteries in central Tibet of Sera and Drepung and Ganden. But he even went and found other commentaries which nobody there had ever seen before in Amdo and Kham. And he said he's going to spend his life researching this. So I didn't know how he could possibly do that. But then I understood that he could put all the texts on computer and then compare them all easily that way. He found a lot of commentaries that the great Geshes, the teachers of Sera, Drepung, and Ganden themselves had never heard of. It's like that. And what we in the Kagyu lineage can do is look at all of Milarepa's songs on the computer and then see which ones are similar and which ones are different. It's like that. For these reasons, these days studying is becoming more and more easy. So since studying is becoming more easy, we have to make it easier to do and easier to understand. That's why we printed this book, Distinguishing Phenomena and Pure Being, with the Tibetan and English on facing pages, so people could study very easily, and also if there were mistakes in the translation, they would be readily apparent. And then we can make it better and better. The next section we'll look at is on page 189. It's the ninth in the sections of describing transformation. And it's the disadvantages, meaning the disadvantages of a view or the logical flaws in a view in which transformation is not posited. So what that means is, or what that's talking about, is that, again, the basic explanation of the Buddha and the third turning of the wheel of Dharma is that you have this wisdom that is the true nature of your mind. And the path is this uncovering of it, this removing the fleeting stains from it, so that it manifests. But you have this support for this process of the wisdom there all along. During the time of the ground, as an ordinary sentient being, it's there. When you're a noble bodhisattva, it's there. When you're a Buddha, it's there. And that's the support for the transformation. Now, what are other alternatives? Well, one alternative is posited by the Shravakayana and the Prachekabuddhayana. And so what they say is that you start out with all of these kleshas, all of these disturbing emotions, causing you to take karmic actions that cause suffering. And the root of doing that is believing that the self truly exists. So what you do is you train in the prajna, or developing the wisdom that realizes there is no self in the individual. Set. And then you stop performing karmic actions. So at that point, you're called an arhat with remainder. So that means that you still have these defiled aggregates. The five aggregates, you still have them because you're still alive. So you're not a perfect arhat yet. You're an arhat with remainder. And then you die. And when you die, since you've perfectly realized selflessness, you have no reason to be born in samsara anymore, so you never come back. So they describe the fruition as being like a candle flame going out. Or water in a bowl that just completely dries up. There's nothing left. That's an example of a fruition posited by a path that does not believe in wisdom as being the support for transformation. Right? So that's one possibility. Another possibility would be that if you didn't, even from a Mayana perspective, if you didn't believe that wisdom was present in the ground, was perfectly present in the ground as the support for the whole path, then, again, you would realize emptiness, not wisdom, but emptiness, and your mind would just stop. Your relative confused mind would just stop. And again, the fruition is, from this perspective, sort of like it's a cessation. It's a cessation of confused mind. So what are the flaws in those two kinds of presentations of a path and a fruition? That's what's explained in this section. So it says, the introduction to disadvantages includes the four that would follow as a result of there being no transformation. Namely, the flaw that preventing affliction's entry would lack a support, the flaw of the path's introduction lacking support, the flaw of there being no basis of imputation for speaking of individuals reaching nirvana, as well as the flaw of no basis of imputation for distinctions between three forms of enlightenment. And if we look at these four bullet points that are at the beginning of the commentary, gives a nice sort of succinct but complete description of these four points. So first, if there's no wisdom that's the support of transformation, then the flaw is that the flaw that preventing affliction's re-entry into the mind stream is already, after it's already having been purged of them, would lack a supporting ground. So if there's no wisdom, then you can get rid of the afflictions, but what prevents them from coming back? If you're just describing the path as a mere elimination of mental afflictions. Mental afflictions are a construct. They're a composite. They arise due to causes and conditions. So, when they go away, why don't they come back? Well, why they don't come back is because one has wisdom that realizes their true nature. If you don't posit that wisdom, then why shouldn't they reappear? In fact, the most profound explanation of this is that you realize that the afflictions themselves are wisdom by nature. That's the best, the clearest explanation of why they don't come back, is that they were just wisdom all along. So the more the better. The more affliction, the more wisdom. Once you realize the affliction's true nature, then they are as they have been from the very beginning. That's why they can never cause any problem. Now, if they're not of the nature of wisdom, then they could be a problem. And that's how the Arhat's path actually sees them, as being something that you have to abandon, because they're fundamentally flawed. But the Mayana, particularly from the sections that we saw on perfect purity, together with the section on wisdom, sees that there's no flaw in the afflictions. It's about realizing their true nature. So once you have that realization, then they can never be a problem again. There's no way that you could slip back. Once you've reached that stage of direct and perfect realization of their nature. So that's the first point. And the second is the flaw of the paths, i.e. the remedies, introduction into the mind stream, lacking a supporting ground. So, if you don't posit the wisdom is there, then what is the basis on which you can practice on the path? One example that's given for this type of path, that's the idea, is it's like trying to clean a piece of charcoal. Right? You just can't. If there's no wisdom, then how can we start to practice from the beginning? On the other hand, because we do posit the existence of wisdom, then we have a basis for, even in the midst of confusion, being able to understand the teachings and starting to put them into practice. Because the true nature of this mind contains the ability inherently to be able to do that. And then it's just a matter of revealing it more and more. But if the idea of the path is that that's not there, then there's no way you can do that. Or another idea that's presented is that you start out with very little, but then you cause your qualities to grow, like you build them up. Right? But the problem with that idea is twofold. First of all, where did it start from? It had to come from somewhere. And secondly, as these qualities are growing, they too are just constructs, right? They're composite entities, they're things, because you're building them up. But whatever is built up falls apart. That's just the nature of composite entities. So there's no stability in qualities of realization that come from a path like that. On the other hand, if you know that the qualities are present in the true nature of mind as being non-composite, meaning not created by causes and conditions, now these are the ultimate qualities, then you're just clearing away the stains of being able to realize them. Then they never fall apart. And again, that gets back to the fact of how it is that the nature of the faults themselves, if you look at their true nature, are these uncomposite qualities. So there's no way they could fall apart. So that's the second point. Then the third is the flaw of there being no basis of imputation for speaking of individuals reaching nirvana. Well, if there's no wisdom that's the support, then when the arhat attains nirvana, then there's nothing left. It's like the peeling the onion, and the onion's gone. So who is the one who attained nirvana? Who is the one who attained enlightenment? There's nothing you can point to. They've just completely disappeared. Actually, that's not what happens to the arhats. They think that that's what happens, but really they just go into this very deep samadhi of peace, but they're still there. Their mind is still there. Because you can't get rid of the mind. Right? You can't stop it. So they've entered this deep samadhi, but then it's like the Buddha comes and opens the drapes, you know, and shines light on them, and they wake up. And then the Buddha says, "You have not reached the final fruition." And they go, "Oh no!" And the Buddha says, "Now you must enter the Mahayana." And they kind of go, "I'm still here, I'm still here." Then they have to enter the Mahayana anyway. Then the fourth is sort of related to the third. The flaw of there being no basis for imputation for the distinctions that are made between the three forms of enlightenment constituting the ultimate fruition for Shravakas, Pracheka Buddhas, and Mahayana practitioners. The reason why we can tell the difference between these different levels of practice is that we can say that one has removed a certain amount of stains. The Shravakas have removed the stains of believing that the self truly exists from their wisdom, so they have this aspect of wisdom manifesting. The Pracheka Buddhas have done that, and they've also, it's explained, realized that the perceived object doesn't truly exist, so they have that amount of wisdom manifesting. And then the Mahayana, from the Bodhisattvas on up, have begun to realize wisdom in its most complete way, which is total non-duality. Not only does the perceived not actually exist, but the perceiving subject doesn't truly exist either. And you can mark all the stages of realization, like we just talked about the impure and the pure grounds, as being an increasing purification of the stains preventing wisdom from manifesting. So wisdom manifests more and more. So wisdom is the support by which you can make those kinds of distinctions. And the example that Nagarjuna gives in his text called The Praise of Dharmadhatu is, he says, you start out with wisdom being like a candle burning in an overturned vase. You know, that you can't see it. But then you start to poke holes in that vase. That's like reaching the first bodhisattva ground. Then the wisdom is shining more. And then you poke more and more holes until the vase completely disappears. And then you're at, all you've got left is the luminosity. So that's when you've reached enlightenment. Right? So if there's no candle, then what's the difference? So the point of this section then, the point of understanding these flaws in the idea that there's no wisdom for us as practitioners is to help allow it to help us gain confidence that we do have this wisdom, right? That the wisdom is present in the true nature of our mind as the support for our practice on this path. And that helps us to not be discouraged. It helps us not to differentiate between ourselves and others, seeing ourselves as good and others as bad, or vice versa, because we all have this wisdom as our basic nature. It helps us to see what is real, which is the wisdom, and what is not, the obscurations. And this is very important for us to do as practitioners on the Mahayana path, is because it's like the basis for the path is to understand that wisdom is your true nature. Like the Buddha nature, the enlightened essence, is the true nature of your mind. That's what it actually is, in an unchanging way. And it's just a matter of removing the fleeting obscurations that prevent us from realizing that.
Tazong. Tene dema jato gupcho kodo gan tani tata. Meba rinpo jindale shimjok chenpo zondo. Shimjok chenpo zuba tenyang de tseng tamale. Jato gupcho kodo ga yingteng tamale. Dada javu jindewa ngama namso shepar masong pe de jepar shepala. Lodi nam jeban zo je sondo ten de he de lo lodi zo je bo lodi den ba so ni bo na go.
And this particular section is one that Mepam Rinpoche did a lot of research into and investigation. He wrote a very clear explanation, and if you look at the end of the whole thing on page 197, at the bottom of the page, he writes, since these points have not been addressed in any detail in earlier commentaries, either in India or Tibet, we have discussed them extensively here. May those of fine judgment find this presentation satisfactory. So this is saying that those who have intelligence to want to investigate these things will delight in this presentation because it's totally unique. He's explaining something in a detailed way that's never been explained, never been explicitly taught before. Mipam Rinpoche was recognized as a noble being by others, and he also affirmed this himself, that he was a noble, realized being. And therefore, he was capable of being able to do this kind of analysis and make this kind of presentation. So we should hold it in high regard. And then the benefits of an explanation of a path that has transformation, that has wisdom as the support, are explained in the lines of root text on page 199. The introduction to the benefits should be known to include these four, but in the reverse. So this is simply a reverse of every one of the disadvantages. For example, before there was no support preventing the afflictions from coming back. Now when there is transformation, there is a support that prevents them from coming back. So we don't really need to go into that too much, because once you know the disadvantages, then you know the advantages pretty much automatically. Then we'll go on to the section that's on page 201, but before we do that, just want to read the last paragraph on page 199, because it's a summary that's very nice. It says, in this connection, it is the wisdom comprising complete transformation that provides the basis of imputation for terms like nirvana, or liberating enlightenment. It is the source of inexhaustible qualities and the genuine support for the fulfillment in accord with their wishes of all temporary and ultimate aims of all sentient beings without exception as far as space extends. Those who know this are the fortunate ones. They should set about accomplishing it. Then if we look at the next section on page 201, the concluding summary employing examples to illustrate the point. To show how phenomena not existing appear, they are likened to dream and compared to illusion and so on. To illustrate the total transformation, to space it is likened, to gold and water and so on. Now, at the very end of the text, we get examples of what phenomena are like and what pure being is like, transformation is like. So first, looking at phenomena, samsara, appears at the same time it doesn't really exist. As Milarepa describes it in the song we sang last night, Ema, the phenomena of the three realms of samsara, while not existing, they appear. How incredibly amazing. So that's amazing that something could not exist at the same time it appears. That it could appear to be there at the same time it's not really there. So how is that possible? To help us understand how it's possible, the Buddha taught many examples, like a dream, like an illusion, like the reflection of the moon that appears on the surface of a pool of water. And these days, we have many more examples, like television, movies, the internet,
email.
And that's very good. So that we live in this technological age is something very good. Because we have all these examples of appearance emptiness. If you want to meditate on appearance emptiness, just turn on your TV and look at the empty forms. And look and see how these empty forms make all kinds of thoughts arise in your mind. Right? Like if you watch a political debate and you have so much attachment to one side of the screen and so much aversion to the other side. Or maybe you feel aversion to both sides, right? And it's just a bunch of lights. And that's it. There's nobody in that little box of your set. It's just a bunch of empty forms. So if the forms themselves are empty forms, then the attachment and aversion that arise as a result of them are also just empty forms. So we have to see all these different ways we can use the modern world to help us understand appearance emptiness. So these are the examples that are given for samsara, for dualistic appearance, for confusion. It appears, but it's not truly existent. It's appearance emptiness. And Milarepa said, since it's appearance emptiness, it's amazing. It's wonderful. It's a dream when you don't know you're dreaming. I'm sorry, it's a dream when you know you're dreaming, right? It's a dream when you know you're dreaming. So the Shravaka explanation is not from that perspective. The Shravaka explanation is that the appearances, the dualistic appearances of samsara are suffering. Samsara is of the nature of suffering. But that's from the perspective of thinking that appearances truly exist. Then they are suffering because then they do cause attachment and aversion and us to perform actions motivated by those, and then suffering as the result. So that's like being in a dream when you don't know you're dreaming. But when we know the true nature of samsara is appearance emptiness, then it's not suffering, it's amazing. It's its actual nature. So that's samsara. Then to look at the transformation, to space it is likened to gold and water and so on. So how could it be, the question might arise, that you start out with all of this confusion and then at the time of enlightenment you don't have any confusion and you're experiencing the great bliss of the true nature of mind and performing limitless activity for the benefit of beings that never stops, and yet there's no change from one state to the next. How is that possible? Well, to help us understand that, we get these examples of space, gold, and water. Because space can be covered by smoky clouds, but those clouds don't affect the essence of what space is. From the space's perspective, it never changes. Same thing with water. Water can be filled with mud, but from the water's perspective, it's always clean. And once the mud settles down, the purity of the water is revealed, as it always has been. Once the clouds clear away, the purity of space is revealed, as it always has been. And with gold, pure gold can sit in the middle of impure minerals, but from the perspective of the gold itself, it's always pure. And when those impure minerals are cleared away, then the gold is revealed, as it always has been. So that's how transformation works. The true nature of mind is always pure. It's the Buddhahood of natural purity. It's just that the stains, which are not part of its essence, are present and then cleared away. But from its own perspective, there's no change. From the perspective of genuine reality, there's no change at all. Buddhas and sentient beings are undifferentiable. So it's only from a conventional perspective that you can say that someone goes from being a sentient being to a bodhisattva to a Buddha. It's like somebody growing up in a dream. There's really no difference. So these examples help us to understand how phenomena are and how transformation is. And if we have uncertainty about phenomena or transformation's qualities, then we can think about these examples to help make it more clear.
Yeah, ta ye ban jo gu dong la. Zai zeng ne, qu dang qu ni nan ban jie bi ce le wer se ba. Gong bu san bian zhe ba zu su.
Fourth is the concluding statement. The verses distinguishing phenomena and pure being, composed by the guardian Maitreya, are herewith concluded.
Jorzane Kachin Kembo Mahantanatang Shama Lotsava Gelon Singe Jamsinje.
And the translator's certification, which states, the Kashmiri Kenpo Mahadzana and the Tibetan translator Shama Lotsawa Gelong Senge Gyaltsen collaborated in translating this from Sanskrit into Tibetan and in correcting their work, thus providing this finalized version. So this is a classic example of what is said at the end of the text about the author and also the translators. There are a lot of texts which were translated once and then translated again, sometimes two or three times. Because the Dharma vocabulary became more and more accepted in Tibetan, and so then once that happened, then people could go back and correct the translations to make them in accord with what became the common vocabulary of the Dharma. And it's good to make the words, the vocabulary of the Dharma stable. These days there are computers, so doing all of this is easy. And there are tapes. You can make video cassettes and all kinds of things. Now let's recite the verses, starting with 189, page 189, the disadvantages, straight to the end.
The introduction to disadvantages includes the four that would follow as a result of there being no transformation, namely the flaw that preventing afflictions entry would lack a support. The flaw of the past introduction lacking support. The flaw of there being no basis of imputation for speaking of individuals reaching nirvana, as well as the flaw of no basis of imputation for distinctions between three forms of enlightenment.
199.
The introduction to the benefit should be known to include these four, but in the reverse, to show how phenomena not existing appear, they are likened to dream and compared to illusion and so on. To illustrate the total transformation to space, it is likened to gold and water and so on. The verses distinguishing phenomena and pure being composed by the Gaudian Maitreya are herewith concluded.
Gyurcsán Lama.
Hello.
The Kashmiri Kempo Mahadzana and the Tibetan translator Shama Lotsawa Gelong Senge Gyaltsen collaborated in translating this from Sanskrit into Tibetan and in correcting their work, thus providing this finalized version.
Yeah. Tachini nam ji ti tse kar chenpo su shi shiwa yin xe yire tene chiran so gigin choke kale kale xe na ten lo tse ke lo tse yin kore te yabu xe yire ngay xe tenpo che koko.
Now we have looked at the more important verses from this text distinguishing phenomena and pure being, and you should take that as the basis and study it together. The teachers should teach it slowly over the course of a year, and then you'll understand it well. Your certainty in it will be stable.
And
also, the great Acharya John Rockwell is here. And if you met with him together and studied this text together and did research into it together, then that would be very good. You'll have a good result. He is not only a great translator, knowledgeable in the words and learned about the meaning of the texts, but he also has the practice experience of completing the required recitations of the Vajrayogini and Chakrasamvara practices. So that's why when he comes and he can't stay for long, but when he does come, if you get together with him and study together, then that's a very good thing to do. It's good to look into these texts that are important to both the Kagyu and the Nyingma traditions, to consider them together, to do research into them, and to understand them. The tradition of studying and practicing the lineages of Kagyu and Nyingma together was widespread at the time of Jamgon Kongtrul Lodur Taye, and so we are just continuing from that.
It's good.
Even as far back as the time of the third Karmapa, Rangchung Dorje, the traditions were unified because Rangchung Dorje requested Dzogchen teachings, Nyingma teachings on Dzogchen from Rigdzin Kumaradza and the Vijayadara Kumaradza, who was a great Dzogchen master. And based on that, he wrote the text called Karma Nyingtik, which is the Karma Kagyu explanation of Dzogchen practice. And that text is now part of Jamgon Kongtrul's compilation called the Rinchen Terzo, the treasury of Terma texts from the Nyingma tradition, and so there are empowerments and transmissions given of it, and so this tradition continues even today, the tradition of practicing Kagyu and Nyingma together. And at the time, Karmapa Rangchung Dorje received these teachings from Rigdzin Kumaradza. He did so with the great Nyingma master, his name was Longchenpa, Longchen Rabjam. And it was the case that the Karmapa was a little bit older, and so he helped Longchenpa with some of his doubts and uncertainties about Dzogchen. And so from the very beginnings of the Dzogchen lineages in Tibet, there was a strong connection between Kagyu and Nyingma. It's like that.
Tene tanda chutu chutu nyeba ne tava zogre. Ten chiran so yang kodore yang so yure. Ten tava so na le la vijam kolo kolo parpe gomba namda somda yonda chuni jipadu here. Tene kolo somba gomba tanda chuta chuni number shevare. Ten le la vore. Tke le la vichasu.
During the second session, you can ask questions, and also there's a discussion group in between, like yesterday in the afternoon, so that's very good that you go to both, and we've made it in a way that's quite good to understand these teachings by presenting the ultimate intention of the second turning of the wheel of Dharma in its form of the three sections on perfect purity and the 12 sections on complete purity, and then the explanation of the third turning's intention as found in distinguishing phenomena and pure being. So you can now compare very easily and see the connection between the two, which makes things quite clear.
Yin kolo parpa chepe kapsa tra tuja tan tada tan yondo chepe kapsa sang chepe jumse chepe kapsa dekhe nyingbo kolo sumpe taba che gugudu yang sarpa ina kale kabudu kolo sumpe taba gomba dekhe nyingbo chepe kapsa yang nelo tuja chepe kapsa kolo parpa gomba che gugudu yang sarpa ina kokale kabore tanda nyega che yore tene lela bo yungre
tambo kolo barbe shepa
tatuta tan yonda dan nam da ke pe kap so semje sang je pe jin jin ke na de de ki ne bu ke go kolo som ba ke go de ki sang je pe jin jin de ki ne bu ke pe kap so ne lo tu ra ke na kolo som ba go ba ke go raba
rela
te tan da ni ga ke re le la yung
otherwise we could explain the second turning of the wheel of Dharma's teachings about how reality is beyond conceptual fabrication, how it is completely pure, free from extremes, perfectly pure. But then, if you want an explanation of, well, how does a sentient being attain enlightenment, then you have to explain the Buddha nature. So you have to bring in the third turning. Or, and that's then difficult for someone who's beginning to understand then why you need this other explanation. Or if you're explaining just the third turning about the Buddha nature, and then you want to say, you want to explain how it is that the true nature of reality is beyond conceptual fabrication, then again you have to bring in the explanation of the second turning. And again, it's difficult for beginners sometimes to be able to make that shift and see how they fit together. So that's why it's very good to do it this way and explain them both together.
Tene tanda chunye namje de sawa tang derwan jomai mam jen derwa tang nyambo ta cho cho so penchen ya yore tene tanda yinjin kepa su xie tundu se na xie devu yore yang nontro yungu mara yabu yungre kapte mure.
Now with this book, Distinguishing Phenomena and Pure Being, we put the Tibetan next to the English, and so people can compare, and people who are good in English can look and see if there are any inconsistencies or mistakes in the translation, and if they know Tibetan, then they can check against the Tibetan very easily. So that's the importance of making a book like this. If the people who are good in English are giving the explanations, then they can make the words easy to understand, and then it becomes easy for everybody to understand the meaning of the text. So doing it this way is important, doing it this way is good. If you have to listen to the teaching, the explanation in detail being given in Tibetan, it's difficult because it's difficult to translate all of the profound words of the Dharma that are being spoken in Tibetan because the language is different. And also the grammatical structure puts the words in different order in the Eastern and the Western languages, and that makes it difficult to translate directly. And the translators have lots of experience with this. Now with these books that are coming out with the Tibetan and the English on facing pages, the Western teachers should take them up and explain them. Don't delay. Explain them now, right away.
Then enjoy Yavatazo, then the Indi, Kikin to Higu. Hakozone.
Hakozone. Yeah. Emena lama sarpa lepini.
Ya sarpa kigre. Lodo nam gitten ger kaduina. Lodo nam gitten kalakabotegre.
Otherwise, if you just rely on the Tibetan teachers, then the Tibetan, when the new Tibetan teachers come, they tend to think that they have to explain everything from the very beginning. So they just give teachings on the four thoughts that turn the mind to the Dharma. And then the old students and the new students are all together, and it's like everybody's just a beginner again from the beginning. That's not a good way. There are lots of books that have been translated and written about the four thoughts that have turned the mind to Dharma, so one can rely on them. And if you can just spend the time of studying them in English alone, then you can go through them quickly. You don't need to listen to somebody explain it and be translated. It's like that. And during our second session, you will be able to ask questions, and you should ask questions.
And
but since before that you have a discussion group, then probably you won't have many questions left over. And if there aren't a lot of questions, then we'll sing songs. May we live long and be free of illness. Enjoy freedom, great resources, and happiness. Next life may we meet in the pure realm. May we always practice Dharma and benefit beings. You have clear explanations translated in books of the second turning's teachings and the third turning's teachings, and also many of Milarepa's songs that explain these topics in a concise way, so it becomes easy. Milarepa sang lots of songs that are in harmony with the first turning's teachings about impermanence and suffering. He sang songs that are in harmony with the second turning's teachings, like the authentic portrait of the middle way, and the third turning's teachings, and also the extraordinary practices of Vajrayana. So there are songs about the whole range of the path. And you can remember Milarepa's songs very easily if you sing them. You can remember them when you're in the midst of great suffering, of great anger, when things are difficult. Still, you can, when you have lots of distractions, still you can remember Milarepa's songs. You can even... What Milarepa teaches about death is the same as what is said in the Heart of Wisdom Sutra. There is no aging and no death. That's why he sings, I've gained confidence that there is no arising. This swept away my taking past and future lives as two, exposed all three realms' appearances as false, and cut right through believing all too much in birth and death. Birth and death are just confused concepts. They don't really exist. When there are confused thoughts, then death exists. When confused concepts have dissolved, there is no death. This is what you should know. Tenrezi la solda.
Okay.